like we did on the roof, looking back on it like we needed some proof. It happened, we were locked out in the cold, peasant creatures with a knife in my hold. I'm starting to think.
Hello, welcome to the Sunstone Firesides podcast. I'm Christina Rossetti, one of the joint hosts of the show. Today, I'm excited to have my first guest on, Dr. Colleen McDaniel. For those who aren't familiar with Colleen's work, she's a professor of history and Sterling M. McMurrin Chair of Religious Studies at the University of Utah. She's a prolific author who has written a range of books that span topics such as the history of heaven, material culture and Christianity, Vatican II, and now Mormon women. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hi, great to be here.
So I'm really excited about this book because it's something that I fortunately got an advanced copy and I got to read and I got to review it. And it's something that was really necessary in Mormon studies and the history of Mormon women. We just haven't had anything like it. So I'm really excited to talk to you about this. And I want to jump right in with something that you talk about in the intro that I think people are going to wonder, why Utah? How did you get here?
So I graduated with my PhD in 1984, back when the dinosaurs roamed the earth, the great 80s. And you probably would be surprised to know that there were no academic jobs in teaching.
Hmm.
So, of course, now there are millions of academic jobs just begging for great PhDs to take. So my husband and I, we went to Germany. And we taught and worked for the American government, and I wrote a couple books, including the book on heaven. I then saw that there was a job opening at the University of Utah. It was for an endowed chair, and I applied and eventually was invited to take the Sterling McMurrin chair. So I came from Germany, from Heidelberg, Germany, where I'd been working for 4 years, to Utah. And I had only minimal contact with Mormons and Mormonism. When I was writing the book on heaven, I mentioned this in the introduction to Sister Saints, I had some contact with the public affairs office in Frankfurt. And they were very, very friendly and very happy and brought Bernhard and I all of these wonderful books from Salt Lake City. So we had good experiences there. And then I ended up at Utah working in a department of history, not a department of religious studies, but a department of history, and had lots of LDS students and students who loved being Mormons, students who hated being Mormons. I had Mormon neighbors and Mormon friends and excommunicated Mormon friends and all sorts of different contacts. So that's how my interest in Mormonism got stimulated.
But bigger than that, I mean, one of the questions I get all the time is, why do you study religion? Like, what was it about religion that was interesting to you?
So I'm pretty much interested in everything, and I've always been interested in everything. And the thing about religion is that you can study art and music and philosophy and theology. You can study politics. You can study social change. Everything. Religion touches everything. You can, and if you're an American religious historian, you can learn about Native American religions. You can learn about evangelicals or Catholics. You can study African American traditions. Since 1965, since immigration laws changed, you can study Buddhism and Hinduism and everything. So if you're a person who has a very eclectic intellectual interest, and you like to span broadly, and you don't see yourself as being a specialist, then studying religion is a way of getting at what is the most meaningful for human beings. It's also exceedingly quirky and entertaining. It's very rich. There's lots of humor in it. You're always being startled by what people do and believe. Mm-hmm. So that's why I love religion.
Yeah, I had a similar experience with just being so interested in what matters most to people. But then coming to Utah, it's suddenly everywhere and you can't escape it. And so that was something that was really interesting to me about coming to Utah to study this particular religion, is that it's so meaningful and it's also so everywhere.
Well, it's not only everywhere, but everyone has an opinion about it. So, for instance, when I taught in the Netherlands, religion, to talk about religion was like talking about, well, as I said earlier, the dinosaurs, or about a museum, or about something your great-grandfather might have done. It was detached from people's everyday lives. But in Utah, people either love religion or they hate religion. They have an opinion about it. It's hot-button topic. It's not just something that your grandfather or grandmother did generations ago. It's very lively. It affects people's lives right now in very intimate and often very tragic ways. So it's, you do religion in Utah where religion really counts. It's not simply something that's book learning.
Absolutely. So when you decided to do this project, and we're going to link it in the description of the show, you wrote Sister Saints, Mormon Women Since the End of Polygamy. Why women? What was it about Mormon women?
Scholars are always looking for gaps in the literature. They're always trying to understand what haven't people been writing on, what's important but neglected. And it just seemed pretty impressive when you looked at the literature that Mormon women were totally neglected in the historical literature. So you get, as I mentioned in Sister Saints, you get the polygamists and the pioneers, and then Mormon women pretty much fall off the, you know, the planet, and nobody knows what happened after 1890. And so it seemed to me that that was the best thing to start, was to try to understand the contemporary period by looking backwards into the past. A lot of historians, we tend to do things like that.
That was one of the things that really caught me about the intro of the book, as you mentioned, that Mormon women have been painted as pioneers or polygamists, and that's it. And that's true. We know about Eliza Snow. We know about Zina Young. Of course, we know about Emma Smith. Some people know about Emmeline Wells. And that's Mormon women. And then today you might hear about predominant Mormon women. What's the woman's name, the CEO of Deseret Book?
Sherry Dew.
But then there's the 20th century, and we don't know anything about them. Why do you think that happened?
Well, part of the reason it happened was Mormon women's history was developed as a response to the feminist movement of the 1970s. So significant historical work was done, and women were looking for a usable past. And they discovered that the women who lived in the 19th century were not like mousy housekeepers, that they were feisty and strong, and they had interesting personalities, that they were promoters of suffrage for women. They had intellectual interests. They worked in all sorts of different fields and areas, including medicine. And this was exciting because women were coming off of the period of domesticity of the 1950s, where they were basically told, you know, stay home, have lots of babies, and be good mothers. And here they've just been exposed to these very interesting characters, pioneer characters. And so, of course, you know, the scholarship is going to be done in that area. Plus, the materials were opening up. The church archives were being more made available to historians to work on. And so women began to do more historical activities. And as the church was opening up its archives, it also was engaging some very influential women to write that history. And that was the state of affairs up until the late 1980s and early 1990s. Then that closed down, and a lot of women's history came to a screeching halt until just recently, when it began to open up again.
And one of the things that's so, when I was reading your book, I was really interested in the 20th century because, you know, I know a lot about up and through the presidency of John Taylor, and then Mormonism stops until the current prophets of the church. And so I'm embarrassed to say, I didn't know Helen Andelin was Mormon.
Yes, well, I think I actually say in Sister Saints that she's the most famous Mormon who nobody knows is a Mormon.
I had,
she's amazing.
No.
She had even gone on a mission, which was unusual for women of that era.
So for people who don't know who she is, really quick, who's Helen Andelin?
So Helen Andlin was a woman who was just a housewife. She had a bunch of kids and she had an unhappy marriage. And she was trying to figure out why her family life was all messed up. And so she got some ideas from one of her friends, female friends, and she developed a program called Fascinating Womanhood. And for women of a certain age, so women who came of age in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, she was just a classic for them. She was a woman who, you know, her book was given to them as wedding presents or graduation gifts. She was a very important character. And she basically told women that if they wanted to keep their men and they wanted to have happy families, that they had to be feminine, they had to be beautiful, they had to take care of themselves, they had to be kind of sexy, but not too sexy. They basically had to act like children. They had to be helpless, because she believed that if women were competent and independent, then the men would not be. And she has this wonderful saying, you know, if you pick the bucket up, then they're not going to pick the bucket up. You know, if you go to work, then they're not going to go to work. Then, because of the feminist movement, she became the spokeswoman for the anti-feminists. So for women who were not promoting equality, but what we would now say complementarity, where men and women have separate and but equal roles. So she was made millions of dollars, but she practiced what she preached, and she followed the business advice of her husband and was not very successful with her business adventures. And eventually she retired and moved to a farm. And we're quite lucky that the University of Utah has her many of her papers. And there's a wonderful biography written by her, by Julie Newfer, who did a great job chronicling Helen Andlin's life.
It's just so interesting that I read Fascinating Womanhood, not for a religious standpoint. I read it in a feminist theory class, but there was no mention of her Mormonism at all. The other thing that's so strange is in the time period that Helen Andlin was alive, there was another famous Mormon woman, Sonia Johnson, who a lot of people might be familiar with as the Mormon woman who led the fight for the ERA in Utah. Why was it so important for you to put those together? We hear so much about Sonia Johnson. Whenever we talk about Mormon women, she comes to the forefront as being important. Why was it important for you to tell their stories together?
So Helen Andlin, actually, in terms of the structure of Mormon culture and what many Mormon women hold value, even if they don't follow her ideas that women should be childish, a lot of the aesthetic comes out of Helen Andlin. So lots of Mormon women enjoy bright colored clothes, very feminine clothes, this idea of wearing dresses all the time, either to church or to work. The idea that men and women have very strongly different characters, this is something that Helen Andlin commercialized. So it existed in Mormon culture of the 1950s, but Helen Andlin was the one who kind of created a way that women could, in a very detailed way, follow that particular path. Mm-hmm. And so we oftentimes forget about, I would say, the more traditional, perhaps the more conservative women in Mormon culture, which makes up the majority of LDS women. It's not a progressive religion. We're not talking about Unitarians. This is a religion that values tradition. And Helen Andlin is in some ways more indicative of the general Mormon female culture than certainly Sonia Johnson. And Sonia Johnson's is very famous, but she actually was only involved in being an outspoken Mormon for like 3 years. So she was not a person who had worked for many years on feminist causes. This was definitely a woman who rose very quickly, became very famous very quickly, was excommunicated, and became a kind of almost a poster child for liberal Mormonism. But she was not somebody who was involved in Mormonism for a long period of time. I mean, she was a Mormon, but she was not an activist.
So these women were kind of doing their own thing. They were creating their world of what it meant to be Mormon at a time where the church was going through a lot of changes institutionally, and the bureaucratic and hierarchical structure of the church was changing a lot, especially for women. What was happening in the church for women, for the Relief Society, that led to these kind of, not auxiliary organizations, because they're for sure not called auxiliary organizations from the church's standpoint, but that led to women creating their own worlds outside of the church?
So one of the arguments in the book is that as the institutional church contracts and actually gets, in some ways, gets smaller, it opens up spaces for non-institutional activities. So what that means is that there were parallel institutions in the church for men and women. So women had the Relief Society, and women were quite involved with that. They had their own budgets. They set their own agenda. They had very strong leaders who were important for many years, 10, 15 years. They were involved in the leadership of the Relief Society. They had a strong cultural role to play in Mormonism. But beginning in the late 1960s and early 1970s, the church began to place all of these auxiliary organizations, which were really parallel organizations, not auxiliary organizations. They began to place them under the priesthood, under the authority of the men. And then the women had less and less power. They were not able to raise money. They were not able to set their own agendas. They were under the authority of the bishop. So that meant that the actual activities that women were doing in terms of the church were fewer. But then what happened was, because the Relief Society was no longer creating a culture for women, then women themselves, like Helen Andelin, could create their own culture. It's not an institutional culture. It's not a culture blessed by the church, although Helen Andelin always wanted fascinating womanhood to be a part of the church educational system. She totally failed at that, but she wanted that. Mm-hmm. And so individual Mormons like Helen Andelin were able to create and make money off of creating a certain perspective of womanhood. So before that perspective would have been created by the Relief Society magazine, for instance, those values would have been supported by the Relief Society, not correlated, not censored by the larger church. But then once correlation comes and says, oh no, we are going to control what the church presents as LDS, as Mormon, as Latter-day Saints, then that kind of frees up a space for independent entrepreneurial religious activities.
Interesting. And that's something that people have been really interested in now, is correlation and what the influence of correlation is and what that's been like for women. Generally, how do you see correlation having affected what it means to be a Mormon woman? Not so much their organization, but in terms of just what it means to be a Mormon woman. Has correlation affected that?
Well, one of the things that's happened over the years, and I think we see this now with the position on pageants, is that beginning in the 1960s, every year the church has gotten, it contracts the number of things it does culturally. So it used to be that there are all sorts of things that happened on the ward level, and women were in charge of running them. I mean, they organized dances, they had bazaars, they had things for children. They were very active in creating a social, cultural life in the church. And the church has slowly pulled away from that cultural activity and focused more and more on the home and on what individual families do on the home. Now, one of the reasons it does that is that the culture it was creating was not appropriate for a global church. Mm-hmm. So the culture of the Relief Society magazine that said, okay, you can make quilts and here's how you can, and we're all, you know, really focused on North American social values, cultural values. Didn't make any sense in Nigeria or Mexico or New Zealand. And so the church decided, okay, we're not going to tell you how to have your culture. We're not going to tell you how you should decorate your home anymore. And we're going to leave that to individual national cultural organizations or institutions or individuals. And so this notion that, okay, we're not going to tell you how to have a Mormon culture, that meant that women were no longer really core in creating a global culture. So the correlation helps, pulls back the kind of Eurocentric Mormonism, but it also pulls back from Mormon women having much of a role in things as well.
correlation gets a pretty bad rap. When we talk about correlation, it's usually with a negative connotation. People talk about how they don't like correlation. They want that church to go back to being a non-correlated church. But what you just said, not so much in terms of what it did for women, but in terms of removing this Eurocentric culture that came along with missionary work, that doesn't sound super negative.
It doesn't. No, I mean, I try to illustrate the positive effects when the church as an institution decides not to comment on something. It allows, it's not simply with women. For instance, the church has decided it doesn't want to talk about where the Book of Mormon lands are. And that has allowed for a huge industry of people to speculate on where the Book of Mormon lands are and take you on travel outings to various places. I wrote about this when I did a study of Mexico. And, you know, it allows for religious entrepreneurs to then use their own imagination because the church is not willing to come down and say this is right or wrong. The church does, of course, take certain stands. When I went to South Africa, there was a problem, or there is a problem in South Africa, because the church has come out against the traditional African practice of lobola, which is a way of exchanging money when you get married. And this has been difficult for women because in traditional South African societies, without lobola, you're not a wife, you're not officially married. And so the non-LDS culture treats you as if you're still a girlfriend. So there the church has decided to take a cultural stand, which is still problematic. And that's a correlation, that's an act of the first presidency making decisions about what cultural activities are counter to theological standards.
That's an interesting example. I hadn't fully thought about that.
Hi, I'm Stephen Carter. Since 1975, Sunstone Magazine has been publishing the best of Mormon thought and experience. And now, Sunstone is also a podcast, where you can listen to audible quality recordings of our best articles, essays, stories, and poetry, both new and classic. Come get a taste with our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone. We look forward to being a part of your journey.
So in this time, 20th century, Mormonism wasn't the only religion that drastically underwent changes. And you are a scholar of a lot of things, not just Mormonism. And you've written a lot about Catholicism. And so I want to know if you could, for our listeners who might not be super familiar with Catholicism, spoiler, I'm Catholic. You've come from a Catholic background. And so you've written about Roman Catholicism, which underwent massive changes in the 1960s. Are there connections there that can be drawn between both of these fairly conservative religions undergoing great change at this time?
So Matthew Bowman is also writing about correlation, and he and I have very different perspectives on how the LDS correlation differs from what happened with the Catholic 60s. And I think part of that is because we look at it from different perspectives. I look at it from the perspective of the people. Mm-hmm. And for Catholics, the council did just the opposite as it did for Mormons, as correlation did for Mormons. So in the Catholic Church, after the Second Vatican Council, the church, the institutional church, basically gave people permission to have cultural differences. So in India, if you went to mass, you could sit on the floor and you would light oil lanterns as opposed to candles. Or instead of having a wedding ring, you would put a wreath on the person who's getting married. So you were allowed to have lots of cultural changes. And of course, the most famous of those is the church liturgical language went from Latin to the vernacular, which means the language of the people, whatever the people spoke. So the Catholic Church during the Second Vatican Council was decentralizing and giving much more cultural freedom. And part of this was because there were so many non-European, non-American Catholics, Catholics living in Asia and in Latin America, and their leaders pushed back against the Eurocentrism of the Catholic Church. And they demanded that their cultures be recognized as valid cultures. So in the United States, for instance, there were many different experimental elements within the Catholic Church during the 1960s and 70s. people were just trying on all sorts of different spiritual ways. Now, that changed in the late 1970s, just like it changed with Mormonism, whereas Mormonism came to a period in the 80s, it kind of cracked down and it stopped this openness. The same thing happened with Catholic Church. After John Paul II became Pope, he became much more concerned with upholding orthodoxy. And it's really only until the most current Pope that there's been a move back towards a more progressive spirit of the council. But in terms of Mormonism, Mormons, I argue, became much more centralized as a religion, as an institutional religion, whereas the Catholics became more decentralized. And this is partially also has to do with the way that the Catholic Church was came out of the Middle Ages, where each bishop had control over each bishop was like a lord, a medieval lord, mm-hmm. and had control over their diocese. So Catholicism has never been as centralized as Mormonism has been.
I think that's really interesting, especially now, at least in, before I moved to Utah, I went to a parish that was super traditionalist, required to wear a veil, the whole nine yards. And so we've seen such an upswing in traditionalism that's fighting against this decentralization. I haven't seen the same kind of reaction to a strong reaction to correlation that the Catholic Church went through.
But see, the very fact that you could have a traditionalist church where they make you wear head coverings and have a Latin mass, the very fact that you could have that shows the importance of the council, because the council allowed for diversity.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
So in one parish, you could have a traditionalist priest who says mass in Latin, and then you drive down the street 10 minutes and you're at a Newman Center church mm-hmm. where there's guitar music and girl servers and totally open to LGBTQ people and so on. And the difference too is now in Catholicism, you can just get in your car mm-hmm. and you can drive to another parish. So right. if you didn't like the veil wearing, you could have just gone and found a parish that you liked with a Catholic priest who did the mass in the way. The mass would be pretty much the same,
absolutely.
But the style of it would be very different. That doesn't yep. happen in Mormonism. Everyone has right. to stay in their ward. And even if you go to a singles ward, you've got the same text delivered in the same way. Mm-hmm. And Mormons pride themselves on that globalization. So if you're in Johannesburg or in Ho Chi Minh City, where I am right now, or if you're in Boston or in Salt Lake, it's supposedly to be pretty much the same.
Yeah, I mean, and that is a big difference, is that I can go somewhere else. So I want to talk a little bit, before we kind of move into the present, because we have a lot to talk about in the present, there's been changes in Mormonism. You have a whole chapter on, it's called Equal Partners, and you talk about the Family Proclamation. And that's something that has been circulating a lot. People have been talking about that more and more, especially with the most recent General Conference. But you have a really interesting comment that you've made in other interviews, and you've also made it in your book, and you call the Family Proclamation a theology of silence.
Right. And you have to buy the book in order to find out what that intriguing sentence could possibly mean.
What could that mean? So we'll leave that there, buy the book, Sister Saints. But what do you think the Family Proclamation did for Mormon women?
Well, what I argue in the book is that it's short. It uses terms and does not define them. And so in doing that, again, it's like the same thing I was saying about correlation. It contracts and it doesn't lay out what it means to be a man or woman, a father or a mother. It never explains in detail what it means to preside or what it means to nurture. And it doesn't say that women can't work outside of the home. It's not specific. It opens up a place for a lot of interpretation. So the more traditionalist conservative people can take it one way, more progressive men and women can see it in another different way. It does stress the importance of the binary, and this is something which I talk about in that chapter. It does not get around the problem of homosexuality, which Mormons see as a problem, or transgender issue. It still stresses that there are two things. What those two things are is rather ambiguous. And I think that's intentional. It was certainly a document which was drawn up for certain political reasons. I think people are well aware of that. But the more important thing is that it left a lot of space for people to pretty much think about the family in the ways that made sense to them, as long as there was a deep respect for this binary. And I think that there's also this notion that Mormonism at its core is a religion that stresses the communal nature of experience. So the key is that there's not a singularity. It's not an individual. It's not even an individual deity. It's a pair of deities. Mm-hmm. It's a pair of people. And so this communal thing, I think, is quite is reinforced in the proclamation.
And there might even be more than one Heavenly Mother. We don't know.
Well, there certainly was in the 19th century. That's sort of one of those things that kind of, I also have a thing called the theology of forgetting. And Mormonism works a lot on that. So you create this, for instance, with polygamy, that there could have been multiple Heavenly Mothers. And then when polygamy, of course, becomes no longer practiced, the multiple Heavenly Mothers also falls out of practice. And now you don't hear very many people talking about multiple Heavenly Mothers.
Kind of along these lines, talking about, you know, the family proclamation happened and there was a retrenchment in this idea of gender. But recently, in the last few days, this idea of gender has come up quite a bit because a lot of people have been saying that the temple is now equal and that the church is now an equal space in terms of gender. And without getting into too many specifics about the particularities of the changes to the temple, what are your thoughts on that in terms of this broader history of women?
So in Sister Saints, I do an analysis of the 1990 changes in the temple. The liturgy is available online, so it's possible to see some of the textual changes. And one of the arguments that I made is that there was significant changes in the understanding of what some Protestants and Catholics might call the curse of Eve. Mormons have always had a happy fall. They've always seen the fall as a positive activity that's happened. They have never seen it as something seriously negative. But like all the 19th century Christians, they held that women had suffered and had to submit to the authority of their husbands because of that. And I discuss in that chapter how during the last change, the church altered the way that it understood the text of this curse of Eve. And it seems to me, without having the text of the current changes or having participated in the ritual, it seems to me that this is simply a continuation of that trajectory, that this is just the final end of getting rid of this notion that Eve was an evil person or a disobedient person or a stupid person, and that instead she's critical and essential for the plan of salvation. And this, again, this goes a bit back to the family proclamation. As a historian, I think it's important, if you're going to say something about how liberal or positive or whatever something else is, you have to look at it contextually. And I do an analysis of Southern Baptists' attitudes and information about how they see the relationship between women and God and how Latter-day Saints do. And Latter-day Saints are far more progressive and more egalitarianly geared than conservative Protestants are.
That's interesting. Yeah, in terms of looking at, you know, the changes to the temple and what's happening, one of the things that's come up, and tying into the family proclamation again, I was looking online for Mormon doctrine or ideas of Mormon, not the McConkie book, but what is a Mormon doctrine, because that's something that is so nebulous. And I was surprised to find the Family Proclamation in this LDS.org description of what is a doctrine. And the Family Proclamation has kind of gone back and forth. Is it doctrine? Is it not? And it led me to wonder about the temple change and whether doctrine informs practice or practice informs doctrine. And if there's a way that these changes can inform new doctrine and can make changes to doctrine. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that doctrine, I think for those rare Mormons who actually speculate about theology, somebody like Valerie Kessler Hudson Kessler, you know, these are things that she's been talking about for a long time. And I think that what's happening is that the church is beginning to see how critical women are for the maintenance of the religion. And as I say in the book, if you lose the women, you lose the future generations. And so it's adjusting in order to bring women more fully and to respond to the kinds of comments that they have. And they are making, because the temple ritual is so important, the ritualistic, the ritual performative aspect will I think shape then how people understand the tradition. It might not ever shape official theology that's coming from scholars, because the church itself doesn't really write theology as far as I can tell. I mean, it really writes devotional speeches and talks. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really critically do the kind of work that a systematic theologian would do. But it doesn't make any difference, because what the bottom line is that people begin to feel that they are much more connected to this ritual and it speaks to their world in serious and spiritual ways. And that seems to be happening for many active LDS people now.
What you just said, you mentioned that women kind of maintain the religion in a lot of ways. And that's not just true for Mormonism, that's true for most religions. And I remember in an interview that you did at the U, you said that in terms of polygamy, that polygamy just wouldn't have worked if women hadn't participated and maintained it fully.
Right.
And I think a lot of people that might be jarring for some people to hear, because it's so easy to look at Mormon women as having been pawns throughout history that just kind of went with the flow. So can you touch on that a little bit? What you mean by how Mormon women maintain the religion?
So if you go back to polygamy and you talk about polygamy, women entered into polygamous relationships because of their deeply felt spiritual sensibilities. And when they had problems with living a polygamous life, they understood it in those terms, and they defined it and explained it in those theological terms. Mm-hmm. If you look at the primary source material, we don't have a whole lot of candid descriptions of polygamy by women. What we do have are a lot of descriptions by their children, and their children did not like polygamy. So the mothers had chosen polygamy for the most part, most of them, as a part of a conversion experience or as a part of a commitment to a religion. It was a decision that they did pretty much as an adult. But the children growing up in these households, they resented the fact that they had 20 other brothers and sisters, that there was never enough food because it was hard to support these big families. They didn't get attention from their fathers. They saw rivalries between the mothers. And so the dark side of polygamy is really felt by the children and less by the women themselves. So if the women had decided that, no, this was something that they did not want to participate in, it would have been very difficult for the men to continue to import women or find women, which is, of course, what the anti-polygamists, the anti-Mormons thought that they were doing. The women were supportive. And it's the same thing with the contemporary period. If someone, mm-hmm. if a mother decides that she is angry with her religion, that she just feels this religion is exploitative, she brings along with her the rest of her children. It's very difficult for children to say, oh, well, I know mom really hates this religion, but I'm going to continue it. And yes, of course, there'll be some children that will do that, but it's she's very influential in setting the religious tone of the family, even though we talk about a patriarchal religion, and of course, men have such an important role in Mormonism. It's the mom who gets up in the morning and makes breakfast and dresses the kids and gets them ready for church. And if she decides to stay in bed on Sunday mornings, it's a lot harder for those kids to see the validity of the kinds of sacrifices that they have to make to be Mormons.
Absolutely. And I see that in the communities that I work with now that are still practicing plural marriage, that if the women said no, the system would fall apart. And so in a lot of, I think we forget that, especially when we talk about such controversial and hard topics like polygamy, we forget that women do have soft power that they use quite a bit. And so I don't think it's such an easy answer. You mentioned at the end.
It does, though, get complicated when you're no longer talking, when you're not really talking about women, but you're talking about children.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about 12 and 13 and 14-year-old girls who really don't know what is going on, then the situation becomes more tricky and more difficult, I think, at that point.
Absolutely agree with that. That's absolutely a problem. It's historically a problem. And in Utah, we know that child marriage is still a really big problem. And it's something that we still need to talk about. When you mentioned moms at the end of, and kind of preparing this next generation at the end, you mentioned that it's up that women are going to kind of determine what happens to Mormonism. Why?
It sort of continues. It goes along with what I was saying earlier, which is that they socialize the next generation. Even though we have lots of men who raise children and there's a lot of co-parenting and men are involved in families, it's very much women who set the pace of religions. And I've seen this in American Catholicism. In American Catholics, if Catholicism was not being sustained by immigration, which is how it's being sustained, if American Catholicism was reliant on second and third generation Catholics, it would be tiny because Catholics are leaving the church, and women got angry about the birth control situation. They got even more angry about sexual abuse. I mean, if you are a mother and you found out that your child was being abused by your clerical leader, this is heartbreaking. And it's a problem to maintain a religion when women feel like they've been abused, that they can't be, that their religion has can't be trusted, the religious leaders can't be trusted, and that they're not getting anything out of it, either spiritually or materially, in terms of social support systems. And the Catholic Church in the United States is somewhat bankrupt financially because of the sex abuse scandals, of which about half of which dioceses have paid for. The other half comes from insurance. But it's financially been really difficult on the Catholic Church, and emotionally even more difficult on women who say, you know, you abused my most precious thing, which is my child.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a hard one. And it's something, you know, that a lot of religions are dealing with right now more and more. And the LDS Church is going through that now, trying to figure out how to address it. So you've handled the Catholics. You've now handled the Mormons. What's next for your research?
Well, I'm working on a new class right now for the business school, which is on God and money. And I'm saying that the class will go from Adam and Eve to the present. So I'm doing a lot of reading on Jewish ethics and Protestant prosperity gospel and Mormon communitarian economics and the Shakers and all sorts of different things. So that's what I'm working on right now.
That's great. My long game plan is to become a Shaker and just move to Maine.
There you go. Have built some chairs, be a tour guide through the, I think there are two Shakers left, so they could use you.
There are. So thank you so much. We're so happy to have had you, Colleen. Make sure to check out Sister Saints, Mormon Women Since the End of Polygamy, an important addition to the field of Mormon studies. Make sure to subscribe to Sunstone for more great content. And if you'd like to help us out, we do have a GoFundMe page that I will link in the description. And watch out for exciting events coming up near you. Thanks.
The song you are listening to is titled Nostrand Avenue by Mormon artist Belle Jewell. You can support her and other amazing Mormon artists by downloading her album End of an Era by Belle Jewell or find her on Spotify.